Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 284, we come back with the Traditional Journal Club. I'm joined by Drs. M. Ali Khan and Priya Vakharia to discuss four recent publications in major ophthalmology journals. They all concern systemic disease in retina, and really the biggest focus is on diabetic retinopathy, medications for diabetes, and their impact on the retina. We start with the study looking at the effect of metformin on risk for age-related macular degeneration. We then cover two separate articles looking at the impact of gastric bypass surgery on diabetic retinopathy, and then end with the study looking at the correlation between diabetic retinopathy and cardiovascular events as well as cerebrovascular events. As always, you can find this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. A list of relevant financial disclosures are in the episode description. There is also a link to claim CME credits. By clicking on that link, you'll go to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website where you can claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be back with one of our journal clubs, joined right now in alphabetical order by Dr. M. Ali Khan from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Ali, welcome.
Thanks, Jay, for having me.
And next, Dr. Priya Vakharia joining us from Washington, D.C. Priya, welcome back.
Good to be back, Jay.
Without wasting any more time, we've got four articles here, all publications in recent ophthalmology journals, all sort of tangentially related to each other, making some sort of weird trapezoid shape, but intersecting at different points. So the first article we're going to talk about has been very hotly discussed and shared. And it's called Association of Metformin Use with Age-Related Macular Degeneration, a Case-Control Study, published in JAMA Ophthalmology. Andrew Blitzer was the first author, Dimitris Kondra, the senior author, and this was published online January 21st of 2021. Priya, tell us a little bit about the study and what they showed.
Sure thing. So first and foremost, they're looking here at the association of metformin use with age-related macular degeneration. And some background on that is that metformin has been shown to have some beneficial effects on age-related processes, including cancers, dementia, glaucoma, et cetera. And so there's some anti-aging effect that's postulated from metformin that maybe it reduces inflammatory markers or increases lifespan. And so the authors wanted to look at this specifically in regards to age-related macular degeneration to see if use of metformin would decrease the odds of developing age-related macular degeneration. So they looked at some nationwide health insurance claims databases, specifically the MarketScan commercial and Medicare supplemental databases. And they looked at patients who were 55 years and older, who had newly diagnosed macular degeneration over about a 10-year period, January 2008 to December 2017. And so basically they found 300,000 affected patients, specifically 312,404 affected patients, and matched these to about the same number of control participants, 312,376. So about 300,000 participants in each group, one group of affected patients and one group of control. And they looked at metformin use over 2 years and found that this was reduced with a decreased odds of developing age-related macular degeneration with an odds ratio of 0.94. Now, the interesting thing, and they show this on table three, if I'm correct, where they show that the low to moderate doses of metformin have the greatest potential benefit. Those have the highest odds, the biggest reduction in odds ratio compared to doses of higher metformin use, doses of greater than 1080 grams of metformin over 2 years. Those patients who had higher metformin use did not have a reduced odds of developing age-related macular degeneration. And the other interesting fact that they found is that patients who actually had coexisting diabetic retinopathy had no apparent protective factor from metformin. And so they postulate that, metformin may have some effect on reducing the odds of developing age-related macular degeneration in patients who do not have coexisting diabetic retinopathy, specifically with low to moderate doses of metformin having the greatest potential benefit.
Excellent summary. Ali, your reactions and thoughts?
One, I was, I'd heard of the kind of the effect of metformin and sort of anti-aging processes. So it was nice or, you know, kind of interesting to read about it in relation to, you know, a common retina condition, obviously with AMD. And I thought it was interesting that the protective effect was dose dependent, meaning it was the lower doses and tended to be in patients, or actually only in patients with diabetes without diabetic retinopathy. So the, you know, the authors kind of talked about this in the discussion where they said that, you know, they don't really know why this is happening. You know, is metformin somehow mediating the AMD pathophysiology process in some way? Or is it, you know, through an effect on blood sugar levels, which, you know, they couldn't assess because they didn't have that type of data. But, you know, the fact that it was only seen in patients without diabetic retinopathy, I thought was interesting. And then, you know, I think it's certainly worthy of looking at in additional data sets to see if it's really true. Because, you know, if there is something there that could help prevent the development of AMD, that would be, you know, certainly an unmet clinical need.
Yeah, and some limitations we'll state now, and they stated them. Database studies have their pros. They also have their cons. They're reliant on these diagnosis codes. We're relying on the records being consistent. And we all know that billing errors happen all the time in terms of how things are coded. And so this is sort of like big data study. Some people argue it's garbage in, garbage out. I think that you can derive some positive information from any type of study, and the numbers here are useful, kind of seeing what's going on and maybe pointing out some associations here. I think they did a really good job in terms of the statistical analysis, but again, there are big limitations in terms of knowing A1C levels, how much is this metformin related to hyperglycemic effect versus other possible effects. You know, Priya, there's a couple other specific things we can talk about, but I'll just say, you know, I think that they did a good job portraying the results. I also think that there's a little bit too much, I think sometimes the language is a little bit strong, for example. So for example, the conclusion, it stated metformin reduces the odds of developing AMD. I guess that's the same as is the odds ratio is less of developing AMD if you were on metformin in the study. But I don't feel like those two statements are necessarily equivalent. Maybe it's just me quibbling, but I think that it's an interesting association, but I don't know whether any causation can be implied by this study.
I could not agree more. I don't think that there's enough evidence here to support that metformin itself decreases macular degeneration risk. And also, we don't know what kind of macular degeneration is this. Is this neovascular? Is this non-neovascular macular degeneration? And even, you know, as Ali said, is it glycemic control? Is it not? There's just so many questions. They even show that other diabetic medications have a reduction in their odds ratio as well. So there's just a lot of questions here. I think it brings up a good question, but I do think further studies are needed.
Ali, you talked a little bit about, and Priya mentioned the diabetic retinopathy association. That's kind of interesting. I mean, I wonder if one possible confounder is, it's never really been explored. Do you think that we've always talked about risk factors in diabetes for developing diabetic retinopathy defined by, you know, the DCCT and UKPDS is blood sugar control and blood pressure control. And certainly there are modifiable risk factors as a diabetic, but I think as we get further along in medicine, we understand that there's, you know, genetic and environmental factors. And there are some patients whose sugar control probably is suboptimal and they don't develop retinopathy. And there's others who may have better sugar control than that patient, but do develop retinopathy. And I wonder, we know AMD is multifactorial as a genetic component. I wonder if there's some correlation between patients who are prone to getting diabetic retinopathy. Maybe there's some overlap there where they may also develop macular degeneration and the metformin isn't necessarily doing anything there because those two can run together. You know, they reference in the discussion that there's not really a known clear relationship between the two, but I don't know if it's that DR is a risk factor for AMD or it's just that maybe there's some sort of underlying retinal sensitivity, retinal quote unquote fragility that predisposes you to get both. I don't know. I think that's a very interesting kind of takeaway. I don't know if we know what it means.
Yeah, I mean, I just like my own clinical practice don't really remember seeing a lot of patients with both diabetic retinopathy and AMD, especially advanced stages of each. So, you know, I think there is something fundamentally different about the pathophysiology that, you know, it seems like an eye maybe would be so affected by one that it wouldn't develop the other pathway, but that just seems, you know, anecdotal, of course, with our own, you know, what we see and what we remember from clinic. But again, with a lot of, you know, AMD, obviously, there's strong racial and ethnic differences amongst populations, which, you know, we're not talking about in the study. So, you know, how many of these patients were, you know, African-American versus Hispanic versus white, I think that's relevant. It would be interesting to know further. You know, the age of the participants in the case cohort, the ones that got AMD, were 75. They're 74.9 years, while the control pool was 64. So even though they were technically matched, it's almost a decade difference. So, you know, who's to say that the control people won't get AMD in 10 years, like the mean of the participant group. So I don't know. Like Priya said, I think it's with a lot of these big data type association studies that it sort of brings up, hey, this is a question to be answered, but now we actually have to go answer it.
Right. Priya, any final thoughts before we move on to the next paper?
No, I think that was a good summary. I think just further studies are needed. I think that was good.
Perfect. Well, let's move on to our next paper. And that is this paper from JAMA Ophthalmology as well, called Association of Gastric Bypass Surgery with Risk of Developing Diabetic Retinopathy Among Patients with Obesity and Type 2 Diabetes in Sweden. An observational study, and you know how much I love Swedish papers. This is by Åkerblom as the first author, Grandstam as the last author. And I'll just tell us a little bit about this paper. So essentially, this is, again, very similar to previous paper, to database paper. This is a register paper. So in Sweden, they have something called the Scandinavian Obesity Surgery Registry and the National Diabetes Registry. And they pulled patients essentially from both and picked out patients with diabetes who had undergone gastric bypass surgery over about a 7-year period. And they matched them with patients. So very similar to the metformin study, there was this matching in the database with patients who didn't get gastric bypass surgery. And the way they matched them was their gender, their age, their BMI, and obviously in time, they tried to match within years. And so they essentially try to get long-term follow-up out to about 2 years and at the minimum and out to 8 years at the maximum, and just said what happened in terms of diabetic retinopathy and other sort of diabetic complications. So the interesting part of this is that these were relatively young patients in their late 40s with an average follow-up almost up to 5 years, and A1Cs for interest were pretty close, you know, 7.6 versus 7.5%. These are actually reasonably controlled patients at baseline. And then when you look at the risk of diabetic retinopathy, it was reduced in patients who underwent gastric bypass surgery. It's a significant reduction. So if you looked at baseline characteristics besides gastric bypass surgery that were consistent with development of DR, higher A1C, use of insulin, lower GFR, higher BMI, and duration of diabetes, all kind of things that make sense to us when we talk about the risk for development of diabetic retinopathy. So they said, you know, this is obviously a database study, there's limitations, but the interesting part of it is there may be a reduced risk to the development of new diabetic retinopathy in the setting of gastric bypass surgery. And in contrast to some other evidence that gastric bypass surgery did not increase the incidence of diabetic retinopathy as been reported in other series. So I'll let Ali go first. Again, database study, there's definite limitations, there's associations, there's this matching. It seems like they did a better job of matching. You brought up the age issue with the last study. This one, they kind of matched it a little better. Kind of your takeaway and reactions to the study and other things that stand out to you.
I think, you know, kind of like you mentioned, that there's limitations on any database studies. You know, obviously it's very prominent in the title of the article, but it's, you know, in Sweden. So, you know, it's a very, you know, distinct population that this would apply to that may not, you know, be applicable to really, you know, any other population, we don't know. But I think, you know, the reduced risk for diabetic retinopathy makes sense with improved glycemic control. And the fact that their dominant risk factors they identified for development of diabetic retinopathy were things that we generally think of as risk factors, including A1C, you know, insulin dependence, GFR, and their overall BMI. So I think the results actually do make sense. And, you know, kind of one of their more policy focused conclusions was that they didn't think that you actually needed any ophthalmology monitoring for diabetes after undergoing these procedures if there was no diabetic retinopathy at baseline. So I think it, you know, partially one of the reasons why they may have done this study was actually to change some of their screening guidelines. But I think overall, despite the fact that it was, you know, in a very specific population, the risk factors they identified for progression make sense. And I think it also makes sense that bariatric surgery would reduce the risk of retinopathy with improved glycemic control.
Priya, are most of your diabetic retinopathy patients hanging around an A1C of 7.5 or 7.6?
No, actually, I was just about to comment on that. These patients are incredibly well controlled. Their A1C is fantastic, and none of these patients have pre-existing diabetic retinopathy. So I don't know that this is as realistic of a patient population as I would be seeing in clinic. I wouldn't say that, you know, the large majority of my patients get gastric bypass, but those that do typically have much higher A1Cs and usually have some element of pre-existing retinopathy.
You know, I wonder, you always think about confounders, right? So this is, you're going back in retrospect and say, who are the patients who are chosen for gastric bypass or elected themselves to have gastric bypass surgery? And they talk about these risk factors. And I just wonder if there's some sort of confounder here in terms of the patients who commit to gastric bypass surgery and the recovery and all that. Obviously, there's huge importance in terms of weight loss and things that will affect metabolic syndrome and blood sugar and blood pressure control. But I also wonder if some of it is also reflective of just commitment from the patient's perspective to their health, right? Like, it's a big investment to go through gastric bypass surgery. And patients will go through this. Anecdotally, patients go through times where they just simply commit to this. And sometimes just purely based on the commitment and, you know, getting sugars under control, diabetic retinopathy can improve or just be prevented. I'm not saying that the patients who developed it, who did not get gastric bypass, weren't trying to control their sugars. I mean, their sugars were obviously very well controlled at baseline, but I just wonder sometimes, like, if the confounder here is patients who choose and are good candidates for gastric bypass surgery, there's some other sort of either physical or psychological risk factor that we're missing in this trial that we just can't capture. I don't know what you think, Eileen.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, you know, technically they match the control group for a lot of these different, you know, things that you might be mentioning, but, you know, you can't control for everything. You know, what makes somebody with a BMI of 40 decide to get past gastric bypass versus someone who doesn't? I don't know. I don't know if that's a factor as well, but, you know, you probably have to be more up to date on the clinical effects of gastric bypass surgery, you know, outside of just BMI. You know, we know that blood sugar control improves to the fact that patients no longer have the clinical diagnosis of diabetes anymore in some cases based on A1C alone. So I think there's something is there, but you know, you're right. These are just imperfect controls to come up with associations. But, you know, it's been well reported now that bariatric surgery in general, this in this case being gastric bypass, does reduce the amount of diabetic retinopathy and sight-threatening diabetic retinopathy. So I think regardless of these other kind of concerns, I think, you know, I think the data at least points to a good effect in reducing the severity. Will that be the case in every patient? I don't know.
You know, I learned something interesting about Sweden, Priya, that I did not know before this study. And if you look at this is unrelated to the main point of the paper, but the mean income per year, right? So they talk about the mean income and they put it in Swedish krona, and thankfully they translate it into US dollars, so I would have some idea what it means. So the average income in the group that decided to have gastric bypass surgery was $23,137. It was $19,514 in the other group. It was not necessarily a significant difference, but there is a difference there. The average income though in Sweden for a household is $31,287. So regardless of group, I mean, this just reflects back to the major point, which is diabetic retinopathy, regardless of country, obviously can affect across the socioeconomic spectrum. This predominantly is going to impact people who have lower socioeconomic status, it seems, even in a very developed country like Sweden.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think we notice that here as well in our patient population, especially in patients who are, it's not even just a socioeconomic thing in terms of money, but also in terms of comprehension of what's going on. You know, there have been a lot of studies showing that there's a lot of confusing information on the internet and patients don't always understand what's going on with their eyes. And not only that, but patients don't have time to take off from work and come see us. And so absolutely, this is a very hard disease for anybody to deal with, let alone patients who have less opportunity than others.
And I'm sorry, I misspoke. I said diabetic retinopathy. They were really talking about diabetes, but I was extrapolating off of that point. And I think
diabetic retinopathy also predominantly affects people in lower socioeconomic status. So Ali, so not to make the bariatric surgery argument more confusing, but we have another paper that came out right around this time in American Journal of Ophthalmology. The title of that is The Impact of Bariatric Surgery on Diabetic Retinopathy. This is a systematic review and meta-analysis. Kaberi was the first author. Hong was the last author. It was Yu as the first author and Hong as the last author. So tell us a little bit about this paper, what they showed, and how does that differ from this study?
I think the topic of this paper is, you know, similar, the impact of bariatric surgery on diabetic retinopathy. But, this is not, database study from one country. This was a review and meta-analysis of 14 studies. So, you know, the conclusion that the authors made from their meta-analysis was that, you know, bariatric surgery is associated with fewer cases of total diabetic retinopathy and sight-threatening diabetic retinopathy. There was a cohort of patients with early worsening after surgery, meaning there was some worsening in patients who had existing sight-threatening diabetic retinopathy, which required, in the author's opinion, more frequent monitoring in the year after surgery, which is a little different than the conclusion made by the Swedish database study, which said that, you know, again, this different population, the Swedish study had no diabetic retinopathy at baseline. They're recommending no additional screening. This meta-analysis was mentioning that it could be worse if you already have sight-threatening DR, and thus you should still be monitored. Their main additional findings were that the risk of diabetic retinopathy for those who underwent bariatric surgery of any kinds, not just gastric bypass, was 83% lower than non-surgical patients. The prevalence of sight-threatening diabetic retinopathy was reduced by 53% in the surgery patients, and 71% fewer patients had any type of diabetic retinopathy progression with bariatric surgery versus those without in this meta-analysis. So, you know, again, you know, further evidence of that beneficial effect, at least on diabetic retinopathy. Just like any meta-analysis is only as good as the papers that are inputted. So they mentioned in their limitations that, you know, the actual prevalence of diabetic retinopathy was very low across all of the studies included. So, the ability to assess change in retinopathy was limited by the fact that the prevalence was low. And they also pointed out that many of the studies they included were underpowered to detect, difference regarding DR incidence progression. So, They mentioned that while they feel that the level of evidence for reduction in all kind of any kinds of diabetic retinopathy was good, their conclusions regarding the reduction in sight-threatening diabetic retinopathy was low.
Great summary. I think this is kind of tied into the previous discussion, so we won't belabor the point. There's a couple interesting points in the discussion, Priya, that they reference other studies and. You know, again, I think it makes intrinsic sense that bariatric surgery, like we talked about, could have many benefits that correlate with reducing risk factors for diabetic retinopathy development. They talk about this idea of rapid improvements in hyperglycemia, which is known to worse diabetic retinopathy. But they did have this rapid progression to PDR, Ali referenced, in the surgical patients at 12 months. This is always an interesting concept, because I really think this is a subtle point. I don't think we necessarily spend a lot of time talking about this. There's been discussion with some of the newer diabetic medications that they may experience in worsening in their diabetic retinopathy when they start it because their A1Cs improve so rapidly. The mechanism this is not covered in this paper and is not necessarily clear. Have you anecdotally observed this? And what do you kind of think about that concept? Do you think that we should be, for example, I guess the one thing we can talk about as a group now is for patients who are getting bariatric surgery, should we be changing our follow-up patterns for these patients?
You know, I haven't seen it as much as I would, you know, hope to see. I find that my patients, I haven't had a patient who's been incredibly poorly controlled and then suddenly gets incredibly well controlled. Usually it's much more of a slow progression. But I do think that there is some element of a delay in terms of blood sugar control versus retinopathy. And I tell my patients this so they don't get frustrated. And this study even comments on it, is that there's probably some type of a metabolic memory or something going on in the eyes where you have sustained vascular dysfunction, even if you have improved glycemic control. And I do think that's absolutely true, in which, you know, a patient will have their A1C under good control, but their retinopathy will progress. I don't know if I see a sudden rapid change all of a sudden when a patient gets on medication in practice, but I think this paper highlights a good point. And I think it's good for us to counsel our patients and maybe monitor them after bariatric surgery to check for this.
Ollie, any other comments on the concept of hyperglycemia and the concept of worsening? And then again, what do you think about monitoring these patients? You know, we talk about in pregnancy, we change maybe our monitoring patterns or frequencies. Patient has bariatric surgery. Based on this, do you think we should be seeing them more often in the first 12 months if they come in with pre-existing retinopathy?
Well, the worsening that they noted in the study was in patients with sight-threatening diabetic retinopathy prior to surgery, which, you know, probably makes sense that we would be monitoring those people pretty closely anyway. And that kind of worsening effect of the worsening of diabetic retinopathy after surgery was not necessarily observed in people with more mild forms or no diabetic retinopathy. So I would probably not change much, assuming that I was already monitoring the people with sight-threatening diabetic retinopathy somewhat frequently as it is. But, you know, anecdotally, I have seen patients who, you know, started a new medication or changed drug regimens that had a rapid improvement in their A1Cs and did have, you know, worsening of their macular edema temporarily. So, you know, I didn't necessarily treat them, but I followed them a little bit more closely to watch their sugar stabilize. And then, you know, their macular edema tended to stabilize as well. So I think it does match kind of what I've seen in clinical practice as well.
So let's kind of pivot to our last paper, which is actually not really related to this, but ties back into diabetic retinopathy and moving away from bariatric surgery. So the title of this paper is Severity of Diabetic Retinopathy and the Risk for Future Cerebrovascular Disease, Cardiovascular Disease, and All-Cause Mortality. So I guess if you have a running theme for this episode, it's essentially crossovers between retina and other fields, where retina is, again, not only unique in ophthalmology, but definitely highlighted in ophthalmology for all the systemic diseases we take care of and the impact systemic drugs can have on the retina, as we saw with the first paper. So this paper was by Bobic, Moch Tahedi, and senior authors Wansu Chen, published in Ophthalmology just in the last month. So Priya, do you want to tell us a little bit about what they looked at in this paper and what they showed?
Yeah, definitely. I really liked this paper. This is one of those papers that it has like real world applicability. And I really, really liked it. So basically what they did is they looked at the relationship between the severity of diabetic retinopathy and then the future risk of having other systemic problems, specifically at cerebrovascular accidents or strokes, heart attacks or myocardial infarctions, congestive heart failure, and then just general all-cause mortality. And they looked at this in all patients who had type 2 diabetes, and they looked at it over 5 years. The way that they did this is this was actually done through Kaiser Permanente. They did it through their healthcare system, specifically through the Kaiser Permanente Eye Monitoring Center. And this study included 77,000 patients with type 2 diabetes. And all of these patients are patients who underwent diabetic retinopathy screening via fundus photographs. So not via an ophthalmology exam, but they were plugged into the Kaiser system and had fundus photographs that were then interpreted to determine the retinopathy scale. And so overall in the study, they had 61,000 patients with no retinopathy, 12,000 patients with minimal NPDR, 2,000 patients with moderate to severe NPDR, and 607, so a small number, but 607 patients with proliferative diabetic retinopathy. And they basically just looked at these patients over 5 years to see what's the hazard ratio of them developing any of those conditions that we talked about, stroke, heart attack, heart failure, and death. And they found that these patients had a higher hazard ratio of developing those, specifically the higher degree of retinopathy you had a heightened risk of each outcome. So for example, just comparing strokes, for example, you had a hazard ratio of 1.31 with minimal NPDR. And then as you progressed into PDR, you had a hazard ratio of 2.53. And so they found or postulated that there was a relationship between your severity of diabetic retinopathy and the risk of developing some type of systemic vascular disease. It's important to note that they did exclude any patient who had a prior history of cardiovascular, cerebrovascular events, and they excluded any patient who had prior retinal laser treatment. And none of these patients, again, were under the care of an ophthalmologist actively. This was all done via telemedicine screening photos. And so this is all, these are all patients who are not established with a retina specialist at the time.
Great, great summary. Ali, we're changing topics here with diabetic retinopathy, but important for us to think about, and really it seems to make sense, and sometimes we still need that data to validate kind of things we may believe. Does this paper surprise you at all? Anything that noteworthy or that stands out to you from the results?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting in that it really is kind of like a new diagnosis based on a telemedicine screen, that type of diabetic retinopathy patient, which is not necessarily people that we see because they've either been seen by somebody else or referred in. The fact that the 5-year risk of these other cardiovascular events was that high, I think kind of underscores how bad this disease really is systemically. And also, you know, the fact that we, as part of like a greater, you know, care team, we send letters to primary doctors and cardiologists and stuff, but we almost kind of, it's just sort of as a routine, we don't necessarily connect the dots. But I think this paper is one of those that really does kind of put everything in perspective. I would say, you know, the average age of the patients was 59.8 years. So, you know, a 60-year-old patient, which, you know, whether these results really apply to our younger diabetics, I don't think so. Simply, you know, based on, you know, the prevalence of these kind of cardiovascular events in younger patients, but kind of our older population, you know, just the fact that diabetes, you know, heart failure, stroke, MI in a 60-year-old patient, all goes together, I think, does make sense to me. But again, seeing it in data, I think is, you know, powerful to kind of hit that home.
Yeah, I think that's a really important, you both guys pointed out that these patients, screening patients, so again, very different than the patients we see day to day. Did they comment on the fact that you just referenced, Ali, that the severity kind of is not as much as you'd expect in a standard retina practice because of that. But that just, like you said, just makes this all the more impressive. Priya, I don't know if you have any final kind of thoughts. I wanted to bring up this paper because I think this is an important thing we don't necessarily think or talk about. We're so busy in our day-to-day with our patients, managing their retinopathy, giving them follow-up intervals, treating the complications of retinopathy, including macular edema or proliferative disease, that if you kind of take a bird's eye view, like if a medical student in your clinic may not be going to retina or even ophthalmology, I mean, this is a pretty serious condition when you terms about the quality of life and mortality. I mean, these are stroke, MI, and CHF, even if they don't result in mortality, there's significant morbidity associated with all of these. So, I mean, I think, again, it's a little sobering to think about and kind of humbling to think about, well, yeah, we are treating, this is obviously very important to someone's quality of life, but there's a big picture here. And that's why it's so important on our end to communicate and kind of work with the primary doctor, the endocrinologist, the cardiologist to put out the fire rather than just blowing the smoke out of the window.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, Jay. I think the papers that resonate the most with me are the ones that I can immediately take and apply to patient care. And this is one of them. You know, I usually see patients who have mild, moderate diabetic retinopathy and, you know, counsel them on the risks of vision loss, et cetera. But this is something that's real. And we see these patients a lot. And, you know, I'll admit, I don't talk to them about their systemic control. I don't talk to them about their other systemic issues, but I think this is a good reminder that we do have to worry about our patients in general as a whole and just remind them that it's not just in their eye that they're having these problems, but also systemically. And we do, as their physician, a lot of times these patients really have a better relationship with us than their primary care doctor. And so I think this is a really great paper just to highlight the importance of recognizing that these patients can have severe systemic effects.
Great. I don't have any other thoughts on this. I appreciate you guys joining for this journal club. We went through 4 terrific articles and all connected to systemic disease in some shape or fashion. I'm not going to take too much more of your time, but quick reaction since we're recording this February 18th and Priya Sharma's one sports connection is the Dallas Cowboys and their arch rival, or one of them, is the Philadelphia Eagles. Carson Wentz got traded today from the Eagles to the Indianapolis Colts. I'll let Priya gather her thoughts first. Ali, just quick thoughts on this. As an unaffiliated Rams fan.
I don't know. I feel like I like the Eagles when they had Donovan McNabb, or the one season they had Nick Foles. Otherwise, it kind of – I don't understand the NFC East in general. So it seems like a mess. I like Jalen Hurts, so I think he deserves to play. So I'm good with the trade. And I think they should have just kept Nick Foles, and maybe this wouldn't have happened.
Priya, I don't know if you know that Carson Wentz got traded, but he did.
He did. He had no idea.
Is this good for the Cowboys? Is this bad for the Cowboys? Or I'm not really sure.
I honestly don't think anything will help the Cowboys, to be honest. So I think the Cowboys are probably going to go another 10 years before they ever end up in a Super Bowl.
There you have it, guys. That is straight from the cutter's mouth. That is a great way to end it. Priya Vakaria, Ali Khan, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for joining us, and hopefully see you both back soon.
Have a good night, guys.
Take care. Have a good night.
Many thanks to Drs. Khan and Vakaria for joining me for this episode. Remember, listeners, you can find this episode and many other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's R-E-T-I-N-A podcast.com. You have 284 episodes there, sorted by category, easily searchable, and archived dating back to when we started back in 2016. Can't believe it's almost been 5 years, been 4 years now and 3 months, but all those episodes are there and great to go back and listen to if there's a specific topic you want to hear about. Remember, you can reach us in many ways. You can email us directly at retinapodcast.com. There is a contact us link on our website. And you can follow the podcast by subscribing in the Apple or Android store, or by subscribing to our mailing list on the website. We're on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast. And we love to hear about episode ideas, things you think we should do better, things we can add in the future, and the things we should keep doing and continue to add to our program. Many thanks again to Drs. Khan and Vakaria. Thanks to Drs. Angela Chang, Mike Venacasa, and Louis Kai for preparing the production and social media for this episode. Thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the patients you take care of every day, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.